like developing concepts that mentioning any developed country.
Thank you.
You mean how they control most of the snus in other developed countries? I'm speaking to the fact level of control and mentioning freedom and the fact that it's a small country and they are all educated and have all those advantages. And what maybe we have them as an example of any developing country where emotion can be brought down by any other level.
I'm not an expert in that field, so I mean I think I've done my personal views on that, so I don't sadly to firm opinions on that. I know what we do in Sweden, and I know that if people regard it as something like the sugar candy, very many people will use it because there are no dangers connected to it. The attitude is easygoing, it's just like food. And if the attitude is that this is an addictive substance that we really don't want people to start with because they are lifelong addicted to nicotine, the attitude changes. So we can influence attitude by behavior.
So maybe one should come to the practicality of the bill. In the bill, we are having a definition which says tobacco product. I just want to have your view in around the definition, because the industry, let me refer with specific reference to BAT, has made it clear that snus is a product which contains tobacco. Dr. Yusuf was here sometime last week. He said there is no difference between snuff, our original African snuff, and snus. In essence, snuff is snus. And Philip Morris was here yesterday. He presented before us. I hope you were around. They were so happy about the fact that snus should be included under this definition. Now, since the bill is, number one, speaking of public health, two, the bill is aiming at reducing the harm, three, the bill is aiming at restricting or prohibiting young people to start smoking, what will be your view on this? Snus can be included under the definition of tobacco product. So as maybe one day if our market is maybe sort of there is snus in the market, maybe there should be a campaign around that. That is one of the tobacco products. It is containing nicotine and the like. Thanks.
Well, my view is that snuff is, as I understand it, your dry product that is inhaled, containing tobacco leaf and nicotine. And snus is just the same thing, but it's wet with water and salt in, and you put it in your mouth. It's just a question of how you deliver nicotine to the bloodstream. So it is as addictive. It's just a question of tradition, what is most sort of popular in the country. So, of course, one tobacco product is the same as another one when it comes to the definition of tobacco. We are all agreed on the fact that smoking it, burning it up, and inhaling it to the lungs, that's the worst thing we can do with it. There are other ways to deliver nicotine to the body, by patches, by chewing gum, by snuff, by snus, by a lot of things. And that causes less harm, yes, but is that a reason to pour it out on a population just in thinking that they will reduce their smoking automatically by this effect? I don't believe in that. I believe in tobacco control in all these other ways. And this modern idea that was created not by harm reduction, because that didn't exist in Sweden, not by policymakers, but by the industry. And that many, even doctors, thought, oh, fine, we can leave all this smoking cessation that is so hard to deal with. We let them get the snus, everyone. It's really it's a capitulation to do so, because people are much more happy when they have left their nicotine addiction. All people that have stopped it most, I would say 99%, are happy to have left the nicotine addiction. Because so many people among those I know who have shifted from cigarettes to snus, they really found the way they did instead of stopping smoking, because every time they try stopping snus, they have greater difficulties than stopping smoking, because they are so addicted to the tonic distribution all of the day. Not one little loss of nicotine in the blood is permitted. They put in a new one all of the time. And that makes the body more sensitive to withdrawal symptoms. They go crazy when they are out of the drug. And that is the difference. And the industry denies this, but working with patients around it, we know that if you have if they said to quit snus, they demand much higher concentrations of, for example, nicotine gum or patches to be satisfied. So they are more addicted. Most of the continuous snus users are more addicted even than cigarette smokers. And that's what I see is unhealthy, even if it doesn't cause a lot of cancer, even if it doesn't kill by pulmonary disease, because this is an effect of your lifestyle that influences every day and minute of your life. And that is also a kind of unhealthy effect.
Thank you, Mr. I actually wanted to check the statement of saying of the one I said, not the one I wanted to check, but here on the touch on it.
That is empirically sound, but very often discussed in different research papers. And I think it's a difficult. Empirically, we can see that people hooked on snus, they are really more addicted because they demand it always. And in my studies, clinical studies, which I did on firemen, they are very often snus users instead of cigarette smokers because they don't pick up fires. But that was so typical that the first dose of either cigarettes or snus, which I asked for in the questionnaire, there were always the snus users that started earliest in the morning to use tobacco. But many of the cigarette smokers, they started smoking after breakfast or a bit later in the day or even in the afternoon, whereas the snus users started immediately after work waking up. And there were some of them using it also at night, the pouches that they could put in during night, not to wake up because of abstinence at 4 o'clock in the morning. Not all, but there are, I mean, for me it's so obvious that snus use creates such a craving, so it's more addictive in the way it is distributed than cigarette smoking. There are also studies on that, but I...
Thank you very much. It would seem that I think the presentation we got from the Swedish match was very misleading.
That's their view, and this is my view, and it is always this when it comes to public health. It's to weigh one's views towards each other, but you have to know about the reality too.
In other words, to the question raised by the Honorable Matsumela on definition of tobacco products, you would still agree that snus is classified as a tobacco product?
Absolutely, and I would be scared if this was to be sold freely like sugar candies anywhere, because then they will pour out it on the whole of the country with advertisements, it will be available everywhere, and just under the label that this is to help smokers to quit, and this is not true. The real thing is to hook new consumers. It has always been, and I don't think this will change.
This match made another recommendation that we want your comment on. They said the bill should distinguish between smoking and non-smoking in the use of tobacco. How would you respond to that?
Because every time you compare snus to smoking, smoking becomes so much more dangerous. If you compare snus use to non-users, people who don't use nicotine at all, it always becomes more dangerous. And that is what we are dealing with in most things in society. Or if we're eating chips or sugar or Coca-Cola or whatever, we compare with people not using it. We don't compare with the ones who use so much. So it's terrible. Look at an alcoholic. Does a doctor go to an alcoholic and say, drink white wine instead of whiskey? No.
Doctor, for your very good presentation. We came all the way from Sweden, and I think it was worth a while. The South African specialist was not still very limited, and I think without you, we have been having very serious difficulties in dealing with some of the aspects of the deal, and I think you really illuminated a number of things in your presentation. Then God will help us. Was this particular issue around tobacco products and definition. So thank you very much. Shall we then call the advocate Patricia Lambert?
Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee. I am known to some and unknown to others. My name is Patricia Lambert. I am currently working as the director for an international legal consortium, the only one of its kind in the world, currently situated at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids in Washington, D.C. I've been there all of 2 months. For 3 years, I worked as a legal consultant in the Ministry of Justice, and for the past 7 years, I worked as a legal advisor in the South African Ministry of Health. As such, with regard to tobacco control, I assisted with the implementation of domestic tobacco control legislation, and I performed work as the chief negotiator for South Africa for the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which was negotiated roughly between the year 2000 and the year 2005. I was supported in that work by two colleagues from the National Department of Health, who are known to some of you, Ms. Zanelli Mtembu and Mr. Hopalong Sekobi. The process so far with this draft bill, and I must emphasize to members of the committee that I am not speaking to you as a government representative this afternoon, but as a South African citizen. But I was involved in the drafting and discussions around the bill. So this is within my direct personal knowledge and experience. It was in 2003 that we produced, as a team in the Department of Health, the first draft for the amendments to the tobacco control laws. They were published for public comment for a month. We have been told that this was insufficient, and the department will, Dr. Chetty has assured us that in future, things like this would be published for 3 months. Despite what committee members have heard in this room, we did indeed hold meetings with all stakeholders, including the tobacco industry, and I shall return to that point later in my presentation. In the years 2004 and 2005, a considerable amount of redrafting was done to the original proposals. This redrafting was done based on comments that were provided by stakeholders, including the tobacco industry, and changes were made to the original draft of the bill. In roughly 2006, the bill was sent through both to the state law advisors and to the parliamentary tagging committee. At this stage, the bill was split into two sections, the 75 bill and the 76 bill. Personally, as a constitutional lawyer and with some experience with Parliament, I am not convinced that the bill should ever have been split. My reason for saying this is that the original piece of legislation and all the amendments to that legislation were dealt with as a single 75 bill in this Parliament post-1994. But be that as it may, the bill is currently split. It has already caused some problems, for example, the definition of brand element straying into the wrong act, which there's been considerable conversation about, so I won't raise that again. But we are dealing with a unitary, a single piece of legislation in two bits, as it were, and that is going to cause some complications. I hope this reflects only my blank moment and not the blank moments of anyone else in the room. I'm going to take us backwards slightly, just to remind us, if we need reminding, of what is before us when we deal with this legislation. Tobacco products, all of them, including snus, are the only products which, if used precisely as the manufacturer intends them to be used, will cause the user and others, in the case of secondhand smoke, death, disease, and disability. So whether snus is carcinogenic or not, it causes disability. The disability is addiction. Now, risky or dangerous? This has now become a very famous photo, and this particular version of it has a caption. It reads as follows: "Trust us, we are the tobacco industry." This is a photograph taken in America, in Washington, in the Congress, when the heads of all the tobacco corporations in America were called to a similar hearing to this one, a portfolio committee hearing, a parliamentary hearing, and they were asked to raise their hands, which is what they're doing in this picture, and to swear that they would tell the entire truth and nothing but the truth to the members of Congress in America. And this is what they did. And what they swore to that day was that tobacco and that nicotine is not addictive. Despite the fact that they already knew, and this has been proved in industry documents subsequently, that nicotine was highly addictive and that their companies were engineering cigarettes to deliver nicotine in the most addictive way possible. And it is that, that is their deception, that has made this photograph so famous. So the industry has been before us over the past few days explaining to the portfolio committee that they acknowledge that their product is risky. Is it risky or is it dangerous? In fact, they want us to believe that the industry has changed. Personally, I would choose other words to describe this product. Risky is when you cross the street, but not at the traffic light. Using tobacco is a lot more than risky. You are placing your life on the line, you are placing your health on the line, you are placing your well-being on the line. We've been told in this room by the tobacco industry that those of us who belong to a movement that seeks the strongest possible restrictions on tobacco are somehow living 30 years in the past. If that was the case, if we really are living 30 years in the past, how come in 2006, which is not even a full year ago, the US government, the finding was held in a case brought by the US government in 1999 against the tobacco industry. It is a very famous case. The judge who delivered the verdict was Judge Gladys Kessler, and she took 1,683 pages to say what she had to say. It is an extraordinary document. It has now been summarized, and if members of the Portfolio Committee would like more information on this court case, I'd be more than happy to supply it. But for purposes of this afternoon's presentation, what she found was that for 50 or more years, the industry has lied to everyone. She says, and I quote, this is a direct quote from her judgment. This case is about an industry that survives and profits from selling a highly addictive product, which causes diseases that lead to a staggering number of deaths per year, an immeasurable amount of human suffering and economic loss, and a has a profound effect on our national health care system. It seems to me, ladies and gentlemen, that if this is the finding of a judge, that the national health care system in a wealthy country like America is affected by the tobacco industry, then how much more at danger are we in a developing country with a much smaller economy? This I would like to share with you because I am not convinced one iota that the industry has changed. Because the industry's reaction to the court case was immediately to approach the judge through the correct legal channels and with the correct legal papers for clarification. What could they still export products labeled light, mild, low tar, etc.? And if you think about their approach to the court, what were they actually asking the judge? I believe that they were seeking permission to export their lies to the developing world. In other words, if a judge says that words like light, mild, low tar, etc. are a lie in America and that they are deceiving the American people, these industries want clarification to find out if they can still export products that are labeled light, mild, low tar, etc., and so deceive the rest of the world. I am not making this up. We have been called emotional, hysterical, old-fashioned, out-of-date, and more. But in fact, everything that I'm saying to you to this afternoon is based on scientific evidence. This is a quote from the preamble to the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which, as you all know, South Africa has ratified. And it reads as follows. Scientific evidence has unequivocally established that tobacco consumption and exposure to tobacco smoke cause death, disease, and disability, and that there is a time lag between exposure to smoking and other uses of tobacco products and the onset of tobacco-related diseases. I will be addressing you this afternoon principally on the history of the FCTC and touching on the amendments to the bill and some of the points that were raised during these portfolio committee hearings for the rest of my presentation. In the 80s and 90s, there was a growing recognition of the consequences of the tobacco epidemic, and various World Health Assembly resolutions, some of them, all of them supported by the South African government, to a greater or a lesser extent until 1994, when our then Health Minister, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, supported these resolutions wholeheartedly. And therefore, in October 2000, negotiations began for the FCTC and 192 countries participated. The negotiations concluded in March 2003, and in June 2003, the treaty opened for signature and ratification. The importance of the FCTC is just this. The WHO, in the year 2000, by the year 2000, the WHO had been in existence for 54 years. During those 54 years, it had always had treaty-making powers. These were not new powers. So why, one asks oneself, suddenly, after 54 years, does the WHO decide to write an international treaty? The reason is simple. They realized that the tobacco epidemic was growing, and they realized that the death, disease, and disability caused by tobacco products is preventable. In other words, we cannot prevent the spread of HIV and AIDS. We absolutely can prevent the death, disease, and disability that are caused by the use of tobacco products, all of them. They also realized that the tobacco epidemic had enormous cost implications for the public health care, especially in developing countries. And it was the changing focus on health care away from developed countries and towards developing countries that gave the WHO the impetus to write the convention. And this is reflected in the preamble to the convention, which acknowledges that there are devastating. I bolded the word, I bolded it. Devastating worldwide social, health, social, economic, and environmental consequences. In another section of the preamble to the FCTC, and I will read this one in full because this affects South Africa very closely. The 192 countries that drafted this were seriously concerned about the increase in the worldwide consumption and production of cigarettes and other tobacco products, particularly in developing countries, as well as about the burden that this places on families, on the poor, and on national health systems. Tobacco control in South Africa has a long and interesting history. We first find mention of it in the ANC's health policy, drafted before the African National Congress came to power. Within the first 5 years of government, of ANC government, strong tobacco control legislation was enacted, and instantly, South Africa became a regional and international leader in tobacco control, something which even the industry now acknowledges. The industry's reaction to the proposed legislation in 1988 in this very room, the industry complained of overregulation, insufficient consultation by the Department of Health. They said that the proposed legislation was unconstitutional. They said that we would drive the tobacco industry out of business. They said that we would damage the advertising and media industries. They said that we would damage the hospitality industry. They said that we would damage sporting codes like soccer, horse racing, and cricket. They said that we would cause massive job loss. And they said that we would decrease government's tax base. So their reaction, in the main, save for the fact that we are not addressing the advertising or media industry in this bill, or the hospitality industry, or the sporting codes, their arguments are the same. The Constitution is clear, and it would be arrogant of me, members of the Portfolio Committee, to lecture you on the Constitution. You are aware that you have the power to regulate trade. You are aware that you have the obligation to protect health. You are aware that every person has a right to an environment that is not damaging to their health or their well-being. And you are more than ever aware that we always balance rights and obligations in order for them to come down on that piece of legislation that most protects the citizens of the country. We heard about job losses. The information on this slide is taken from industry documents. I did not make it up. In 1986, there were 74,000 people employed in the tobacco industry. In 1996, there were 35,000 people employed in the tobacco industry. This represents a loss of 39,000 jobs over a 10-year period before strict regulation was introduced. So yes, there are job losses in the tobacco industry. Where do they come from? One of the principal reasons is the mechanization of the industry. Tobacco farmers. We've heard a lot about the poverty of tobacco farmers and how much they are going to struggle if we do any more legislation. Also, the statistics come from tobacco industry documents that are freely available. In South Africa in 1986, there were 1,500 tobacco producers. In South Africa in 1995, there were 700 tobacco producers. In other words, in the 10-year period before strict tobacco control measures were implemented, 800 farmers stopped producing tobacco. Why? Because the industry began to import cheaper tobacco from elsewhere. Taxation. We have heard that the tobacco industry contributes 8 million rand to the tax base in South Africa. I beg to differ. The tobacco industry does not contribute the tax. Smokers do. All that the industry does is collect the tax and pass it on to government. Now, that money that is part of the tax is in people's pockets. If you don't spend it on cigarettes, people will spend it on something else. The money doesn't disappear. Taxation again. From 1997 until 2004, a period of 7 years, government tax on tobacco products was 50% of the price of the product. That was changed in 2005 to 52%. Of the price of the product. So this massive tax rise that government is supposed to have done is simply not there. For 7 years, the tax stayed at 50%, and for the last 2 years, it has been at 52%. So the issue is basically this. The price of the product is set by the industry. Government does not set the price of the product. If the industry wants to increase its profits, it increases the price of the product. And the taxation, therefore, increases only in relation to the price set by the industry itself. We've heard a lot about illicit trade. This I say to you, backed by knowledge. The tobacco industries are currently active themselves in illicit trade. Whether that is so in every country, in every place, and at every point in time, is a matter for conjecture. But here is my proof. In 1997, in a trial that was held in London, the Rembrandt Group sued Philip Morris because the Rembrandt Group was accusing Philip Morris in South Africa of smuggling cigarettes. In 2006, the South African Revenue Service and the South African Police Service raided a tobacco company called Mastermind in Johannesburg. It is a legal tobacco company. The company was accused of defrauding the South African government of 48 million rand using something that is called round tripping. And what you do in round tripping, if you are a part of the tobacco industry, legal or otherwise, you write up your books to say that a certain amount of tobacco product has been exported. In other words, you don't pay tax on it in South Africa because you're exporting it. But in fact, you don't export it. You then sell it in South Africa, and you defraud the South African government, in this case, of 48 million rand. In 2005, in Europe, the EU investigated Philip Morris, a legal tobacco company. The case was never brought to court, unfortunately, but I think that it is very telling that Philip Morris settled and are in the process of paying $1.25 billion to the EU in what I would call an admission of guilt. By definition, illicit trade is illegal. It is against the law. There are legal provisions elsewhere in the South African system to deal with illicit trade in all products, including tobacco. The proposed amendments to the Act before you do not apply to trade. They apply to health. This is the second slide on tobacco farmers because we've heard about Malawi and how the tobacco farmers in Malawi are suffering terribly, and in Zimbabwe, and in Zambia, and in Tanzania. I'd like to bring these facts to your attention. They come from the 13th of September 2006 issue of the Tobacco Journal International. Burley, which is the type of tobacco that is produced in Malawi. These are sales figures for Burley. Before I go through the sales figures, though, I would like to tell you about what the Malawian farmers that we worked with during the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control explained to me about what they call the poverty trap. The baby tobacco plants and the fertilizers, those things are supplied to the farmer by the industry or associates of the tobacco industry. The farmer then puts his labor and the labor of his family, usually including his children, into this product. It is a very labor-intensive product. It is then dried, cured, and taken to market where it is sold. So when the product goes to market, the tobacco farmer already owes the tobacco company money for the baby plants and for the fertilizer. Now, let us look at this. In 1996, the price for tobacco for Burley in Malawi, bought by the tobacco industry, the tobacco industry paid $1.60 for a quantity of tobacco in 1996. In 2003, they paid $1.22. In 2005, they paid 99 cents. And in 2006, they paid approximately 83 cents, and I say approximate because this figure was a guesstimate based not on a full year's sales. Now, the cost to the farmer, the cost of producing that, is $1.22. So the last time that the tobacco farmer in Malawi broke even was in 2003. And this problem is so bad in Malawi now that the Honorable President of Malawi has called the tobacco industry cheats and thieves. Stakeholder consultation. We have heard ad nauseum from the industry that the Department of Health does not consult with them. I find it extraordinary to hear this. Personally, on behalf of the Minister of Health, and together with my colleagues in the Department of Health, already named, and including Henny Kleinhans from the legal unit, Zanelium Tengu, Kopelang Sokobi, Blanche Pitt, going back as far as the department's records on these laws go, we always consult with the industry. I think the problem lies in the fact that we do not consult with the industry whenever the industry wishes to consult with us. We all have a great deal more to do than that. But I think that the problem runs deeper. It seems to me that the industry's interpretation of consultation means agreement. In other words, when we haven't agreed with them, we haven't spoken to them at all. We've been told that we cannot possibly legislate or regulate tobacco and tobacco control until we have visited tobacco farms and factories. Well, I honestly, if every single parliamentarian had to visit every single factory, every single organization, every single bit of the South African society in order to legislate, Parliament would simply never sit. Now, we've also heard about loopholes in the tobacco advertising, in the Tobacco Act as it currently stands. This is one that I would like to bring to your attention. This is a little leaflet this says, and I do have copies for everybody of this particular, color copies of this. And I couldn't get it bigger on the slide. I couldn't get it bigger on this, but I can read it to you. The front of it shows two packets of cigarettes, and there's a number on the far right-hand side. At the back it says, call 0800 Dunhill now to enter the finer things in life prize draw. There are 12 5,000 Rand shopping vouchers to be won. The closing date for entries, and please notice this because this is a tobacco industry that obeys the law, the closing date for entries is the 31st of August 2006. The prize draw may only be entered by adult smokers over the age of 18. This was picked up in a bottle store. Now, technically speaking, only 18-year-olds enter into bottle stores. So, technically speaking, they're not reaching out to children. But if I, as a mother or a father, take this home and put it beside my telephone so that I can phone in, give the number, and hope to win 5,000 Rand so that I can enjoy the finer things in life, what guarantee do we have that this kind of advertisement or promotion is not being seen by young people? Members of the Portfolio Committee, I'm a lawyer. The tobacco industry has lawyers. I have met with the tobacco industry all around the world on many occasions, lawyer to lawyer. I am told that this is legal on a strict reading of our current law. That may or may not be so. I'm saying that we should do with this kind of thing exactly what we do with all other laws. We take them to the courts and we ask the courts to interpret the law to see whether this is actually legal or not. And I would then take this opportunity to urge the Department of Health to sue the industry where it believes that the industry is breaking the law. Here's another loophole. The Act prohibits smoking in public places and workplaces. That's what the Act says. Smoking is prohibited in public places and workplaces. Then, by regulation, the minister creates exceptions. These exceptions have been abused by the hospitality and casino industries, and I could give you dozens of examples, and we'll happily do that during the question session. But there's another unintended consequence of the way our law is worded, and that is why we are asking this parliamentary committee to change the law, to help the department to change the law. Semi-enclosed areas, like patios and pavements, since the law began to operate in 2001, January of 2001, those areas have been set aside exclusively for the use of smokers.
If you're a non-smoker, you can go and sit on the patio, but you run the risk of inhaling tobacco smoke, which is carcinogenic. Now, we have the most glorious weather in South Africa. I'm sure that all of us who protect our health and our well-being by not exposing ourselves to secondhand smoke would also like to use the outside areas of restaurants, the patios and the pavements. And so that's one of the things that this legislation is asking you to consider. I'm returning now to the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control and will stay there for the rest of the afternoon. Once the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control was concluded, we needed 40 ratifications to bring the treaty into force. Those 40 ratifications were achieved in just 29 months, making this treaty the most rapidly embraced treaty in the history of the United Nations. Why? Because it is important. Currently, 143 of the 192 member states of the WHO have ratified the treaty. In other words, 75% of the countries that designed the treaty have now ratified it. Another 25 countries have signed but not yet ratified. There is a distinction in international law, members of the Portfolio Committee, between signature and ratification. If a country signs the treaty, it intends to be bound by it. But it isn't actually bound by it until it ratifies. And most countries ratify through an act of parliament, which is how you became involved in the ratification process. In April 2005, South Africa ratified. A country like the United States of America has signed the treaty years ago, but has still not even submitted it to Congress for discussion, let alone ratification. So the countries that are agreeing to be bound are the countries whose example in tobacco control we need to follow and with whom we need to cooperate. I've dealt with that. That simply illustrates in a slide for what I've already said. Now, we have heard from members of the industry that South Africa's legislation is strict enough, we are over-regulating, and that our legislation, except for one or two things, principally the age at which we sell tobacco to children, we still sell tobacco to children at 16 years. Government has long wanted to raise this to 18 years, and this is now our opportunity, but that is in the second bill that is coming to you. In order to better protect human health, parties are encouraged to implement measures beyond those required by the Convention and its protocols, and nothing in these instruments shall prevent a party from imposing stricter requirements that are consistent with their provisions and are in accordance with international law. What this means is that the FCTC is the floor for tobacco control. It is not the ceiling. We in South Africa are perfectly entitled, in fact we are encouraged, to lift our regulation to a new ceiling, not just to stay on the floor. The FCTC on taxation, I've selected these sections from the FCTC. They apply to the current discussions. The parties recognize in Article 6.1 that price and tax measures are an effective and important means of reducing tobacco consumption by various segments of the population, in particular young persons. Now here's something interesting that I've noticed in South Africa. I've been in and out of the country over the past 18 months or so. I was in the United States writing a book on the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, and now, as you know, I'm working in Washington, and I'll tell you more about that later. But for many years in South Africa, tobacco was sold in packages of 20 or 30. Not exclusively, but mainly in packets of 20 or 30. Suddenly, the industry has produced packages of tobacco products that have, I think it is 10 cigarettes in them. I wonder what the reason for this is. For young people, and people who do not earn very much money, there is, to buy in a single purchase a package of cigarettes that is 20 or 30 is much more expensive than 10. So by simply changing the packaging, the price changes, and that makes tobacco more affordable. And then there are also the issues around loose straws, and we can talk about that in the question period. I'm happy to answer questions about that. And then when this is in the treaty in Article 6.2 that says that when countries set price, when governments set their price and tax measures, they have to take into account national health objectives. So here is the linking in international law between health objectives and taxation and pricing. And they further say that tax price policies must contribute to the health objectives. Regarding the contents of products, the contents of the parties, and this was alluded to this morning by JTI, Japan Tobacco International, the contents of the parties, which is those parties, that those 143 countries that have already ratified the treaty, are discussing guidelines for testing and measuring the content and emission of tobacco products. There were questions asked in earlier discussions last week whether South Africa is in fact competent enough, whether we have the skill and the expertise and the experience to regulate the content and emission of tobacco products. My answer to that would be simple. Yes, we do. And any shortfall, anything that we do not have, we will get from the international community, from neighboring governments, from governments all over the world, from international organizations that will help us, because the FCTC places upon all parties the obligation to help one another and to exchange technical information. So we can do this thing that we are asking for in the act that is before you. And this is an obligation in the act. Each party shall adopt and implement effective legislative, executive, and administrative or other measures for such testing or measuring. So the department isn't suddenly thinking, I know, we'll regulate another part of tobacco control. The legislation that you have before you is in fulfillment of this article of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, and South Africa is bound by that. Product disclosure, this is pretty much the same thing. Each party shall, it's an obligation, adopt and implement effective legislative, executive, and other measures requiring manufacturers and importers of tobacco products to disclose to government authorities information about the contents and emission of tobacco products. So again, this is not something that the Department of Health is seeking to do in order to make the lives of the industry participants more difficult. This is what we are doing in fulfillment of our international legal obligations. Illicit trade. Article 15 is a very long article. I'm sure you're familiar with it, that the members of the Portfolio Committee are familiar with it. This suggests ways of curbing in the illegal trade, illicit trade. And governments are encouraged to use methods of tracking and tracing products, collecting data on cross-border trade, and confiscating the proceeds of illicit trade, and are obligated to pass legislation to ensure that we keep illicit trade to a minimum. Secondhand smoke. The Conference of the Parties has mandated a working group to propose guidelines for what we do with secondhand smoke. I participate in that working group as a member of a non-governmental organization. We met in Dublin in October, November of last year, and we will be taking to the next meeting of the Conference of the Parties the proposed guidelines. They are not published yet, but they will be published in time for the Conference of the Parties, and I'd like to assure members of the committee that those guidelines are trying to achieve the highest possible protection for people from secondhand smoke. And then, sorry, if you wouldn't mind, I just want to go back to the secondhand smoke. In case we think that secondhand smoke is not a huge and dangerous thing, there was a court case in Canada recently of a woman who worked in a bar, in a couple of bars. She sometimes did a double shift. She was a single mother. Her name was Heather Crow. And she struggled to put food on the table for her daughter as a single mother. So she would often work two shifts in bars where there was a great deal of smoking. Having never smoked herself, she developed lung cancer. Heather Crow died last year. Before she died, she approached a quasi-judicial authority in Canada, and she was given the equivalent of work person's compensation for the damage that she had suffered. Now, I keep thinking about our own restaurant workers. They do not necessarily know the dangers of cigarette smoke. And what we have proposed in the new legislation that we've laid before you for your consideration is that we do the best that we can to protect our workers who may not know that they are endangering themselves from having or being forced to work in areas where people smoke. Manufacturing standards. I won't go into this in great detail, save to give you some of the articles in the convention which deal with manufacturing standards. And to repeat what Mr. Sela Ramasala from the South African Department of Health, from the legal unit, has explained, an example of the kind of data that is given to by the industries is given by the pharmaceutical industry to the minister. And that data, as Mr. Ramasala pointed out, is carefully guarded by the minister. So I think that the industry should find itself in a position where it can, on the basis of evidence, trust this government to be discreet with the industry and not to blow their trade secrets. The industry itself. This brings me to an area of the FCTC that elicited much debate. But this is now what the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control says to those of us who have ratified it. It is found in Article 5.3. In setting and implementing their tobacco control policy, In setting and implementing their public health policy with respect to tobacco control, parties shall act to protect these policies from commercial and other vested interests of the tobacco industry. In other words, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, we can engage in stakeholder dialogue with the industry. But in terms of the ratification of the FCTC, we still have to protect our policies and our legislation from commercial and other vested interests of the tobacco industry. So we cannot be swayed by arguments of the industry possibly losing some profitability, because that is a commercial interest, and we are here to protect public health, and that too is in the industry, in the FCTC. By contrast, the FCTC ascribes in Article 4.7 a totally different role for non-governmental organizations like the Cancer Society, like the National Council Against Smoking. It reads as follows. The participation of civil society, in other words, NGOs, is essential in achieving the objectives of the convention and its protocols. In the negotiations, every single government was enormously helped by the non-governmental organizations who had worked in tobacco control for decades. These included universities, traditional NGOs and non-traditional NGOs, all of whom gave valuable input, and that is why their input has been recognized by the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. So I find it very difficult to hear a colleague like Dr. Yusuf Saluji, who is a world authority. He was called as one of the co-conveners of the last World Conference on Tobacco or Health in Washington, D.C. in July of 2006. He convened this meeting. This is a prominent South African who has made his mark in the world because of his knowledge, experience, skill, and expertise when it comes to tobacco control. I think we can trust him. This is to prove that not all legal presentations are as dry as dust. We are not emotional in the legal profession, but we are often not funny. I'm hoping that this will provide you with a little amusement. I don't need to tell you that this is a duck. This is also a duck, but they don't look the same. The point I'm making is this. If it quacks like a duck, and it looks like a duck, I think we can safely say it's a duck. Why? I want to relate this to snus. Snus is a tobacco product. Snus contains nicotine. I leave the rest to you. You've heard a superb presentation from an independent health practitioner who has never taken money from the tobacco industry about snus in its entirety. Now, in the South African context, most nicotine is either in a tobacco product like a cigarette or snuff or snus, or it is in replacement therapy. It's called nicotine replacement therapy. Now, nicotine replacement therapy, what have I done? I sabotage myself, it would appear. Okay, I leave this to Peter. The point that I'm trying to make, honorable members, is this. Nicotine replacement therapies contain nicotine. Some of it is patches, some of it is gum. These products, thank you, Peter, are very, very strictly controlled by the Medicines Control Council. They are regulated. The purpose of those products is to reduce nicotine dependency and aid in cessation. If you look at snus, however, snus is being marketed to increase tobacco industry profits. If snus is really so successful in reducing nicotine use, the industry would not be promoting it because it would be contradictory to what their shareholders expect of them, which is to raise the profits on their products. So, if nicotine replacement therapy is used to reduce nicotine dependency, snus is used to maintain dependency and addiction. And it is for this reason that at our peril do we remove snus, do we alter the current definition that is before you of a tobacco product. If we were to remove it, that would open this product up to advertisement. My goodness, ladies and gentlemen, if we remove this product from the definition, the industry could start giving it away. This is so, and I'm very sorry that I'm not that technologically advanced yet, but I'm learning. I have some wonderful photographs. I have them and would be happy to show them to members. They are on the memory stick. Of the way that snus is manufactured, is marketed in South Africa. It is sold in fridges. You can see glass fridges where you can clearly see the product. It's Peter Stuyvesant, it's Swedish Match, it's whatever. On top of the fridges are containers, which amongst other things contain this. This is an education for the consumer on how to use snus. Now, on my reading of the South African law, this amounts to the promotion of a tobacco product. This actively encourages people to use snus by telling them how to do it. And again, I would urge the Department of Health, in my view at least, as a lawyer with considerable experience in tobacco control, nationally and internationally, this is a flagrant violation of the South African law, as is this. And I would therefore urge the department to sue the industry to stop them from doing this again. I took the information out of my slide on organized activity because it's going to come up again in the reading on the next portion of the bill, and that's a good place for it to be. I would just like to say this. On my reading of the law, it does not prohibit the industry from using its letterheads, naming its buildings, or making signage to direct you to a room where you can go and enjoy hospitality. But we will deal with that with the second phase of this bill. I am ending now. The SCTC speaks about strong political will. Article 4.2 says, strong political commitment is necessary to develop and support at the national, regional, and international level comprehensive, multi-sectoral measures and coordinated responses. If you will permit me, South Africa has shown since 1994, since the ANC came to power, South Africa has shown the most extraordinary political commitment towards tobacco control. The two health ministers that we have had in our first, how are we, 13 years of democracy now? 13 years of freedom? Both of those ministers, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma and Dr. Mandi Chabalala Mzimande, have been unwavering in their commitment, as has the South African Parliament. I do not see a single reason why this should change. And I'd like to tell you very, very briefly about the only thing that took me beyond South Africa's borders to earn a living elsewhere was an international need. The political will for tobacco control in South Africa is strong. It's always been that way since 1994. However, in other countries in the world, that political commitment is not so strong. And there is growing international concern about this. So Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the current mayor of New York and one of the 25 richest men in the world, in August of last year, donated $125 million of his personal fortune to international tobacco control. As part of that, they set up in Washington this international legal consortium, and I was asked to become the first director of that legal consortium. The reason that I was invited in a world full of people who know a great deal more than I do is because on behalf of the South African government, I was able to indicate domestically and nationally as a spokesperson on the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, that this country would not be moved. It would stick to its political commitment. What I will be doing over the next 2 years is working in the 15 developing countries with the highest incidence of tobacco use: China, India, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Russia, the Ukraine, Turkey, Egypt, Brazil. I've left out six, but can give you them if I apply my mind, in order to encourage those country governments to show the same political commitment that the South African government has already shown. So, I would then urge this committee to support the legislation that the Department of Health has put before you. I urge you to support it not because South Africa is a leader in the world of tobacco control, but because it makes good sense. I urge you to support it because it will achieve its objectives. It will reduce smoking and addiction. It will protect people. I urge you to support it because the people who drafted this bill have the knowledge, the skill, the experience to be able to draft legislation like this. We are not living in cloud cuckoo land. We are living in the real world. Finally, I urge you to support the bill because it is the correct thing to do. It is the healthful thing to do. And in the words of one Elisa, the young woman who addressed us last week, and I quote her, she said, "We the youth depend on government to protect us." Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Advocate Lambert, for your presentation. I think it will speak very well with the last part of questioning and during the process of the public hearing. We would like, if members like to ask any questions. Honorable Makilela.
Thank you, Chairperson. And Advocate Patricia, thank you so much. That was very informative. And where I'm seated here, I'm very enlightened. You have really opened my eyes to know what is happening in the world, especially in the developing countries. I just want to make to say something about when electricity started in South Africa for the blacks, because we did not have electricity. But what was done is that when they put electricity in your house, they used to give you a kettle, a two-plate stove, and an iron. And those three things are the most consuming of electricity. So this is exactly what is happening in the farmers, like you said, Malawi and these other countries. You think that you are being helped, and yet you are being ripped off. Then at the end of the day, it says black people can't control their economy. You have really, really, really opened my eyes. Now I understand. And I was very worried about this news thing, because what my dark continent, Africa, is doing is always wrong. There's nothing that is right that is being done by Africa. We have snuff that our grandmothers used to use. There was no danger in it. And my worry was when it was said about snooze, that you can put it in your mouth, you swallow it. We've got nicotine in it. Then we've got caffeine, coffee. which is causing causing heart disease. That is why the caffeine-free coffee. And yesterday it was said that snooze, when you swallow snooze, it doesn't go to your lungs, it doesn't do what, but it gets into your bloodstream. Definitely it must cause something. When at the end it was said, it also causes mouth ulcers or mouth pests or something of the sort. And when it came to farmers are losing, people will lose their jobs and farmers, what. I am from a rural place where there are farms there. The farmers most have stopped planting or growing tobacco. But instead of leaving the fields empty and dry, they have switched to something else. They have planted oranges, some of them, and some of them have planted grapes. So I don't see how people are really losing their jobs and how people are losing their income when they've got something which has substituted tobacco. Thank you so much. Thank you, Shepard.
Thank you very much. I'm humbled by your words. I think that you have a good grasp on the reality of tobacco control in the world. And I know that as a South African there, I for one have been so very proud of the way that the African governments conducted themselves during the hearings on the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. I didn't want to overload you with information, but this I would like to share with you. After the very first meeting in Geneva of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the South African Minister of Health asked the WHO to convene a meeting in Johannesburg for the African countries. We are 46 countries from Africa in the WHO. For the 46 African countries in the WHO to meet in Johannesburg so that we could discuss the SCTC on African soil, since we are the developing world that the industry has its eye on. You see, smoking has fallen in the developed world. Now the industry must look for new markets. Where are they going to look? Why, of course, they're looking at the developing world, and that's what the WHO recognized. So these 46 African countries, we met 5 times on African soil. From the first to the last in the negotiations, we spoke with one voice. This has never been done in the history of treaty making, that African countries attended the entire treaty-making conference, were strongly present, and in the case of this treaty, we insisted on the strongest possible language for tobacco control. And I can share these with you if anyone is ever interested. Newspapers all over the world, once the convention was finished, spoke of the leadership role of Africa. And so you're right, our continent often comes in for a great deal of disparagement and criticism. But in this, I can assure you, we are doing the best that we can. And the other wonderful thing that's come about through the SCTC is that the inter-country cooperation is very strong. Just before I went to the United States, the Minister of Health phoned me and asked me to go to Namibia because the Minister of Health of Namibia wanted some help with their tobacco control bill. So I went together with my colleague Ken Klanghans. We went together to Namibia. And when we were there, we were discussing with the Namibians why they hadn't ratified the convention yet. No, sorry, we didn't bring it up. One of the Namibian health officials said to me, "Ah, Patricia, isn't it a pity that we can't ratify the convention?" So I said, "Why can't you ratify the convention?" So the member said, the health officer said, well, we can't ratify the convention until we pass domestic legislation. So I said, but that's not true. And I opened up the convention and we went through it, and indeed it isn't true. What the convention says, that after you ratify, you have a period of time. Because you don't make legislation in a day, it takes years. So you have a period of time to make legislation. So I said to them, you were in the negotiations with us, in Africa, in Geneva. How come you have this idea? And the answer was, well, we were told by the industry that we could not ratify until we had legislation. So the point that I'm trying to make through this is that through the SCTC, we are not just promoting tobacco control in South Africa, we're doing it for everybody in Africa. And we all still keep in touch. Through the email, we, all of the health officials who participated in the SCTC still keep in touch.
Okay, I just want to check with maybe one need to echo the same sentiments of Honorable Matibere around the presentation. But I just want to check with the slide, the last slide on page 3, and maybe make some comments on page 1 on the last slide. Trust us, you are the tobacco industry. You know, I've never been translating the learned elders, but I do get this. This picture of this red tights and black suit, it reminds me, they claim this picture of maybe there's a one of the learned elders of Zion. I've never seen this. So for the, let me come back to my question. I just want to know, because it has been mentioned on the last slide, on page 3, that the industry imports cheaper tobacco. I just want to know as to whether the industry, there's a proof to it, because this sort of the industry is involved in illegal trade. Do we have maybe some sort of a proof or what it is in relation to this cheaper tobacco, except maybe being given the fact of Philip Morris and Rembrandt on the next slide. I just want to know about that. And again, maybe one can make a comment around Section 5. Maybe somebody check, can you help me? Section 5 of the bill. Page 5 of the bill. Section 5 or Section 7. Section 5 or 7. Offenses and penalties. I just want to make a comment around it as to whether the industry doesn't actually want to make maybe some sort of a noise around this in relation to slight to one slide around around the presentation. I've never heard anyone from the industry making a lot of noise around the issues of penalties, because at a certain point they go up to a million. As to whether the industry knows how to actually, or I'll come later to this question because I wanted to link it to one of the slides. I'll come back to it. Thank you.
Fines are not related to the industry, but to those workers are dealing in restaurants, public places, and other things. So that might be what you have not seen. Thank you very much. Advocate number.
Thank you, Chair. Whether the industry imports cheaper tobacco elsewhere, the industry produces papers from time to time on how it operates, and this information comes from the industry's documents. So that is proof in its own way. But there's something else that I didn't add to this again so that I don't overload you. One of the reasons that the industry uses less tobacco grown in South Africa is that they are able to source tobacco duty-free, so they don't have to pay duty on it, from our neighboring states, from Zimbabwe and Zambia, if my memory serves me. So, if the industry is really so concerned about the welfare of South African farmers, why don't they stop getting duty-free tobacco from somewhere else? I would say that the answer is perfectly obvious. If they don't have to pay duty on the tobacco that they bring in, then it's cheaper. They make more profit out of it. You see, whenever you look at any industry, even the tobacco, you know, the tobacco industry included, every industry exists to give the maximum amount of profit to the shareholders. That's just common business sense. So whatever is said by the industry must be evaluated against the fact that they wish to make a profit. I have no difficulty with industries making a profit. If you make a profit on washing powder, that's okay. I have some issues about bottled water and the corporate owning of water, but that's for another debate altogether. Clothing, whatever it is, furniture, it's fine for you to make a profit. My problem with the tobacco industry is that even though this product is legal, it is also lethal. So we cannot make the product illegal. You ask this honorable member so often in the last few days. The reason that it has been proven that making the product illegal doesn't work. In fact, when they tried to make alcohol illegal in America, that's one of the things that gave rise to organized crime, to the mafia. So it's not rational to make the product illegal. What we can do is, through control, try to, as much as the Indian industry tries to raise consumer demand, we can try to decrease consumer demand. That's the best that we can do. So, the reasons are out there, honorable members, that the cheapest tobacco is imported, there's duty-free tobacco imported, and as the other honorable member said, if our farmers, they don't let their land lie fallow, they turn to other crops. And the fascinating thing is that the other crops have food benefits or some other commercial benefits for the people living immediately on the land. And those crops do not deplete the quality of the soil in nearly the same way that tobacco does. It truly depletes the quality of the soil.
Mine is on page 4. No, wait a minute. It's on consultation. When you started with the 1993, when you started with your drug. I can't find it, but it's when you started with your first draft in 1993, and you invited all the stakeholders. You have been accused, the department in fact has been accused by some of the tobacco companies that in fact the department doors closed for them to negotiate. Now, I would like to know from you, because you were part of this negotiation, did you consult the, in particular, BAT, when you were drafting the 1993 draft, and also when you redrafted, just remember which year was it, but you redrafted in 2003, did you consult them all the way through?
Thank you, honorable member. I'm delighted that you asked that question. With regard to consultation, Let me say this to you. It's a process that we have chosen, and I use we very loosely because I'm no longer part of the department. But when I was a part of the department's tobacco control team, this is how we handled it. We would publish the laws or publish the regulations, and I'm going way back to 2000 when the original act, before it was promulgated. We would publish the regulations or publish the act. The industry received that act alongside all other stakeholders. They then provide us with written commentary on the act, and some, not all, request a meeting. When a meeting is requested, we meet with them, sometimes as a group, sometimes one by one. It depends on what the industry has asked for. One morning I remember Zanelli and Tembu and I, the industry asked to meet with us, and so we gave them it was British American Tobacco and JTR. They asked to meet with the department, and so Zanelli's secretary set up the meeting, and we gave them two time slots. I'm making this up at, say, 11 o'clock and 12 o'clock in the morning. And the next thing, they phoned and said, well, we need to talk to you about the same thing, so can we come together and talk to you for 2 hours instead of each of us talking to you for an hour? So the statement that we do not consult with the industry is totally false. I was there, and unless I was having an out-of-body experience, I was in the room and we were talking. What I think is different, and what I think the industry is looking for, is that we should go to the industry and ask them how they think we should write our policy and our law. And that makes no sense to me at all. We have in our country sufficient expertise, sufficient experience, sufficient skill here, and we have access to all of the African countries who participated in the FCTC, so regionally, and beyond that we have access to people all over the world who work in tobacco control. So we know what works. We listen to the industry. On the 2003 draft, we had drafted some things that, when the industry pointed it out to us, were open to misinterpretation or were not going to serve the interests of tobacco control in our perspective. Once they showed us a different perspective, every single one of those was changed. Now, how could that have happened if we didn't have some form of consultation? And that's why I make the point that consultation does not mean agreement. Consultation means I hear you, I think about it, but I will still make up my own mind about what I think is right to go into the bill. And that is for every single member of the team. Then we put our combined knowledge, skill, and expertise together and redraft or say we're leaving it the same. It's a similar procedure to what is happening here. The industry approaches the portfolio committee and says, we want you not to use this definition of a tobacco product because it will include snus. Do they honestly think we didn't know that? Of course we did. We specifically wanted snus covered by the regulation, by the legislation and the regulation, because it contains nicotine, because it is addictive, and because it does damage health. It may not be carcinogenic, but for goodness sake, if we were only able to call ourselves unhealthy if we had cancer, what do we do with all the other things we get that make us unhealthy? What do we do with diabetes? What do we do with irregular heartbeats? The industry makes the point to you frequently that it consults with, and that they are more open to consultation, the following government departments: SARS, Agriculture, the Department of Trade and Industry. Of course they do. The Tobacco Corporation is a corporation, and it's involved in farming. What he's farming is immaterial. So I am sure that the Department of Agriculture consults with the tobacco industry in the same way that it does with the apple growing industry, with the maize growing industry, with all of those other farming industries. That is their job. They look after agriculture and industrial agriculture. Let's take SPARs. There is taxation on cigarettes. There is taxation on companies. SPARs talks to all the companies. It talks to iron and steel companies. It talks to car manufacturers. It talks to whoever. The tobacco industry is only one of those. The industry says it has better cooperation from the Department of Trade and Industry. Of course it does. The Department of Trade and Industry is there to look after the industries that are working in South Africa. This is not the Department of Agriculture. It is not the DTI. It is not the South African Revenue Services. It is the Department of Health. And as the Department of Health, it deals with health. What the tobacco industry produces is never, ever healthy. So we do consult with the industry when we regulate them because we are regulating them. Let me give you an example of what comes out of these consultations. When we were looking at advertising, promotion, and sponsorship, the tobacco industry sponsored the Rotman's July. It sponsored soccer and so on. So we consulted with the sporting code and the industry to find out what would be a reasonable period of time to phase out those sponsorships. We were told by the industry and the sporting code that 3 years or 5 years would be a reasonable time. The tobacco control team at the time, I was not part of it then, discussed it. I came in later, so for the later part of the discussions, I came in after 1999. And we discussed it amongst ourselves. We then phoned other countries, like Canada, like New Zealand, like Australia, all of which have strong tobacco control laws, and we said, how long did you give the industry? And they said they thought that 6 months was reasonable. So we did it for 6 months. So this is just to illustrate to you, Mayor, that the expertise and so on is out there. We do not ignore the industry with things that directly affect them. So, for example, we are looking to put picture warnings onto cigarette packets. Okay? So we will talk to the industry about how long it will take for them to change their machinery to print the pictures on the boxes, pictures like the ones of teeth that you saw today. Those are the kind of pictures we're looking for. Cigarette smoking causes impotence. So there's a very clever picture of a tobacco cigarette doing this. So those are the kinds of... It means that smoking causes impotence in men. So the cigarette is shaped like this. So we will talk to the industry about how long they think it will take, but we don't really talk to the tobacco industry. We talk to the printing industry. We talk to the packaging industry. And we say to them, if we wanted to do this, how long do you think it should take? And somewhere, the industry may ask for 2 years. The paper and packaging industry may say a year, in which case we're going to be guided by the paper and packaging industry because this is a question of health, not of helping the industry to keep its profits up.
Thank you very much. Another machine?
Thanks, Jefferson. I really don't have much other than to ask. She has been involved, I think, in the previous legislation. I hope she has seen this amendment bill. Whether in her own understanding, is there anything that is not presently included in the bill which she may recommend for inclusion? for purpose of achieving the objectives that we have set.
Thank you for the question. As I said earlier, the bill has been split into two sections. So if you look only at the bill that is before you now, there is stuff that is glaringly missing. For example, we need to raise the age at which young people can buy tobacco to the age of 18, because that's what's in the FCTC, but because it's also what we believe as a health measure. So there is a lot of stuff that is not in this bill, but it is in the next bill. And so if I may, Chairperson, without being presumptuous in any way, I do not intend that, but it would seem to me that it would be a really good idea for us to start hearing on the second bill very soon after we dispose of this bill, so that all the information that we've gathered as part of these hearings can also be taken into account with the next lot of hearings, and then we can deal specifically with advertising, with packaging and labeling, which is the picture warnings, with raising the age, and all of those things that are in the second part of the Act. So to answer your question, there is stuff missing from this draft of the bill, but it is in the second part. In this draft of the bill, there are a couple of places where I would have said to you, we must remove organized activity and brand elements because it belongs, this is a technical slip up, it belongs in the other bill. But I didn't feel the need to do that this afternoon because other people have said it and the chairperson has accepted that. So there are a few editorial changes which I discussed with Ms. Kane Hunt, who will be leading the process with yourselves for the line-by-line analysis and changes to the Act. Those are typographical. If you talk about substance, I believe that this bill is good, and I don't think that beyond typography and little errors, we should toy too much with the substance.
Thank you very much. I think somewhere in your submission you were saying there are some loopholes, i.e. the question of public spaces and sending and posting. I think you were referring, I think, to the definition on public places. And you were there saying that the areas of sending and closed patio and pavements are not covered. You're suggesting that we should put that in the definition and correct the bill.
Thank you for the question, Chairperson. As I read the definition drafted by the department, that covers it. We... may I just fetch my act? On page 3 of the bill, as you have it before you, and on section H, the new definition of public place, which replaces the old definition where the loopholes were, reads as follows. A public place means any indoor or enclosed or partially enclosed area which is open to the public and includes a workplace, a club, and a public conveyance. In other words, smoking is banned everywhere except on the streets. The minister may make exceptions to that, and the exceptions that we currently have are that 25% of a bar or a restaurant can be set aside as a smoking area. That is supposed to have, under the current regulations, it's not in the act, it's in the regulations, that is supposed to have a separate ventilation system, floor-to-ceiling partition, and a door that remains closed all the time. Now, there's one of the problems. The door can't remain closed, so the smoke drifts out, so we're not protecting people as well as we can. So that will be regulated. So you will pass the regulation that enables the, you will pass the legislation that will enable the minister to, with technical experts, draw up the regulation so that we can protect people. And what it amounts to basically is that if all of these laws are passed by Parliament, the two bills together, the way that they are, the only place that smokers will be able to satisfy their addiction will be in smoking rooms, which will be strictly regulated, and outside on the streets. And even then, we say in here that smokers must move a reasonable distance away from open doors and windows and so on, again, to stop the smoke from drifting in. Because, you know, in South Africa, we, environmentally, we're very lucky. We don't use much air conditioning, although I'm told by Eskom that we're using a great deal more than we ever used to. We open our windows. We look for the cross breeze. And, of course, that's what brings the stuff of smoking. So I think that that's covered in the action.
Now, we had a lot of presentations by Swedish Nash, Dr. Bodinger and others on snus, reflecting on penalties and offenses. Would it cover snus?
It most certainly will cover snus as long as we do not tamper with the definition of tobacco product as it is in the new proposed act. In that case, snus is fully covered as with all other tobacco products.
You are suggesting that the definition of tobacco products should stand, going along with Dr. Bullinger?
Dr. Bullinger, yes. It should stand exactly as it currently is.
And in that way, the penalties and offenses would be covered.
Yes. And in that way also, hopefully, this kind of thing will eventually no longer be produced. Because these things lie around in shops and are picked up by who? I want to see a shopkeeper who checks that every person who picks up one of these is over the age of 18. And my greatest concern about snus is because you can hide it from your parents. Because you can hide it from your parents. Young teenagers who want to buck the system. You all have teenage children. Every now and again, they want to buck the system. One of the ways of bucking the system is to use a tobacco product. If you're in your home, say, and your son or your daughter is sneaking a puff of a cigarette, you can smell it. Or if they do it outside your home, you'll smell it on their clothing. That's one of the dangers of snus. You can't smell it. So, and as Dr. Bullinger, which blew me away, was saying that in Sweden, based on her research, there are Swedish people who keep snus in their mouths for 13 hours consecutively. Now, have I understood that correctly? They change the pouch, but there's some form of snus, there's some dose of snus in their mouth for 13 hours. You can't smoke for 13 hours. So you're getting even more nicotine into your mouth via the snus. I would truly suggest that it is, this is what my grandmother would have called a wolf in sheep's clothing. or a duck. If it quacks like a duck and it looks like a duck, it doesn't matter what color the feathers are, it's a duck.
Well, thank you very much, Advocate Patricia Lambert, for your very wonderful presentation here. Honorable members, we have come to the end of the submission. We are going to be coming back to yourselves for the proposed way forward in terms of the actual deliberating with the bees. Of course, as you know, we'll go through it in an informal process, take into account various comments that have come, and then come back to it in a formal process, passing each and every sentence and clause, and then come with the actual passing of the whole bill itself. And Mr. Bossal, you owe us some information as part of the process, I'm sure. Maybe you still have some other things to say, not to say rather to present in a written form to Jerry Polchina as part of that particular process, so that you can see the weight of some of the issues there you've already raised. I know BAT has given us a formulation of 1 or 2, some other things. We'll have to take all those things and evaluate each one of them as we move towards the finalization of this particular process. We really want to thank everyone who really had the dedication of time to be here and make a very valuable, all of us, a very valuable comment to the bill. And I'm sure the process will be something all of us will live with. Thank you very much for your time. I'm sure the key outside. Thank you.
Thank you.